From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. In 2012, American Theo Padnos was kidnapped by Al-Qaeda in Syria. He was held hostage for almost 2 years. He tells that story in the new documentary, Theo Who Lived.
There was a window at the kind of high up in the bathroom. He goes, look out this window. Out there is the sun. This is the last time you'll see the sun. Do you understand? I said, yes.
Also today, we touch down in New Hampshire, where a new WBUR poll shows Hillary Clinton holding a 7-point lead. We'll also talk about how a long-running feud between Donald Trump and former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu has come to an end. And comedian and Peabody native Gary Gulman.
I have a theory that Christians have an angel and a devil on their shoulder, and Jews have other Jews on their shoulder.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's start today with, yes, you guessed it, politics, but it's important, and especially important in the battleground state of New Hampshire. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is here. He's been in New Hampshire this week, and he joins us now with some latest and interesting poll numbers from here at WBUR. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
So BUR had a poll that looked at the presidential race. We'll talk about that in just a minute, but let's start with these just-released numbers we have on the Senate race in New Hampshire between Republican incumbent Kelly Ayotte and Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan. What does the BUR poll find?
Yeah, and this is a really key race, as you know. So this is one of a handful of races around the country that could determine who gets control of the Senate. So the race has been a dead heat for a long time, and that's pretty much what the WBUR poll found. It gives the Democrat, Maggie Hassan, a 2-point lead, 48% to 46% over Kelly Ayotte, the incumbent. That's well within the margin of error. The poll suggests that folks have pretty much made up their minds. Just 3% of them are undecided. So this race remains really close.
Wow, just 3% undecided.
Yeah.
Interesting. And what explains how close it is right now?
Well, Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan are pretty much seen as the state's two most popular politicians by far. And if you look at our poll, they both have very high favorables, close to 50% each, though Hassan does a little better. They're both supported more or less equally by the state's independent voters. And they're both moderate. Ayotte is a kind of centrist Republican, Hassan a kind of centrist Democrat. So all that adds up to a dead heat in one of the country's key Senate races.
Wow, so it's going to be all about turnout. Well, yep. give us a sense as to what they're running on, and if they're so close, how they're trying to distinguish themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting because they're sort of running campaigns that are mirror images of each other. Maggie Hassan is very much focused on national issues, and she's trying to cast Ayotte as a tool of Washington special interest. She's happy to hitch her political wagon to Hillary Clinton. So here she is early this week at a Clinton rally at UNH in Durham, New Hampshire, going after Kelly Ayotte.
Wall Street special interests have given Senator Ayotte's campaign $2.5 million, and she has stood with their agenda in Washington. She voted against allowing students to refinance their loans while voting to slash $90 billion from Pell Grants, which would affect roughly 23,000 New Hampshire students.
So while Ayotte, Hassan's making this case that Ayotte is beholden to special interests, Ayotte accuses Hassan of being a rubber stamp for D.C. Democrats. And Ayotte, who was the state's attorney general before she went to the Senate, presents herself as an independent who's willing to reach across the aisle, buck her party's positions on certain issues, including on environmental issues. So here's a clip from one of her political ads.
As your attorney general, I fought to protect New Hampshire from out-of-state polluters, and I've done the same in the Senate, crossing the aisle to protect New Hampshire's clean air and water.
Now I'm supporting the Clean Power Plan, which will help address climate change with clean energy solutions that preserve our environment. And I believe we need to...
Okay, well, so all of this, Anthony, of course, is unfolding with a couple of names at the top of the ticket on the presidential race. How is that affecting the New Hampshire Senate race?
Interesting, in an interesting way, and again, in ways that reflect sort of opposite strategies. So Governor Hassan, happy to hitch her political fortunes to Clinton, as I mentioned. Ayotte has a bit of a problem with the Republican guy at the top of the Republican ticket, Donald Trump. She says she supports her party's nominee, but that she's not endorsing Trump. So it's a little bit of an awkward balancing act there. And one more thing about this race, Meghna, it's attracting a huge amount of outside money, close to $50 million so far. The AP says that number could exceed $100 million, which would be a record for any political race in the state of New Hampshire.
Wow, $100 million for a New Hampshire Senate race. Okay, well, so that's set the stage nicely for us to talk about the presidential contest in the Granite State. I mean, you've been spending a lot of time up there. WBUR's poll just out this week finds a 7-point lead for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. I mean, what stands out to you in the polling?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's in line with a number of national and battleground state polls that have come out since Monday night's debate that have shown, suggested that Clinton got a bit of a bounce post-debate. So it suggests that after watching her sizable post-convention lead over Trump all but disappear, Clinton has put the brakes on that and is gaining some ground. She now leads Trump 42% to 35% in New Hampshire. But consistent with previous polls, this one also identifies a big challenge for both candidates, and that is that neither of them are very well liked. 51% have a negative view of Clinton. 61% feel that way about Trump. The poll also shows that Clinton continues to build a really striking advantage among women. Almost half of them view her favorably. But get this, 70% of women view Trump unfavorably. 70%. So here's Steve Cozzella, president of MassSync Polling, which conducted the survey.
That translates into votes. You know, there's going to be a big gender gap, but it's the size of the gender gap, I think, that makes a difference. And when you see these numbers, how few women view him favorably, I think that's real concern for him.
And Meghna, finally, the poll also found that by a 3-to-1 margin, New Hampshire voters thought Hillary Clinton won Monday night's debate. That's also consistent with a number of other polls around the country.
Okay. Well, before we let you go, Anthony, tell us about this long-running feud that's been going on between Donald Trump and former New Hampshire governor, Republican governor John Sununu. That actually came to an end recently. So what's happened?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. So back in January, John Sununu, the former Republican governor and former chief of staff to George H.W. Bush, President Bush, warned voters against drinking the Trump Kool-Aid. Trump was happy to fire back, at one point tweeting that Sununu couldn't get elected dog catcher in New Hampshire. And here he is at a rally in Windham last January going after Sununu.
John H. Sununu has been known. He was fired by Bush. And he was fired like a dog. He was fired viciously. And he's such a dumb guy that he doesn't even know he was fired.
And here's John Sununu responding to that.
Trump really has no substance, that he's all mouth, that his outburst today just shows another reason why he shouldn't be commander-in-chief.
And throughout the year, Sununu called Trump dumb, a political chameleon, a perpetual loser, among other things. But this week, John Sununu endorsed Trump, calling him the only candidate in this race who can bring bold change to Washington. So all is forgiven. The Kool-Aid's okay, apparently, Meghna.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that Sununu's son, Chris Sununu, is the Republican nominee for governor this year and has endorsed Trump.
Wow. I'm having images of a giant dancing red pitcher of kitty drink in my head at the moment. Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Wellesley College is making a little history today. The famed Women's College inaugurated its 14th president. She's Dr. Paula Johnson, the first African-American president at Wellesley. Johnson has long been a groundbreaking leader in the field of women's health. She founded the Connors Center for Women's Health and Gender Biology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and served as its chief of the Division of Women's Health. So why the jump to a college presidency? Well, we met with Dr. Paula Johnson at Wellesley earlier this year when the college first announced her selection.
It's a tremendous honor, and quite frankly, right now I'm just feeling all kinds of emotions of just overwhelming joy and pride. To be able to lead this amazing institution with its history, with its focus on educating women who make a difference in the world over generations. And where my life path has led me, which is focused on women, to kind of come to this point in my life is a dream come true.
Well, so what made this the right moment for you to transition into academic leadership on this scale?
You know, I have focused on in medicine, in women's health, and focused on women in general, improving their health, educating them and really focused on their development. And this, that journey, which has been a wonderful journey, got me really thinking and focused on higher education and really looking back a bit and thinking about the opportunities to shape the lives through the educational experience of young women. And I also was, you know, have done a lot of thinking about my own field of women's health, which is really taking biology and thinking about biology through a very different lens, and then combining it really with other fields, sociology, economics, and others. And if you think about that, those are so rooted in the liberal arts. And without a strong liberal arts base, the field of women's health would not exist. So it's the convergence of my long and deep interest and focus on women and thinking about this field and backing it up a bit and really becoming quite passionate about higher education and higher education for women.
Interesting, because, you know, on the trip over here, I was thinking that for so long you've been a vocal leader on exactly these issues that you were talking about. I mean, specifically, we were looking back at articles that you'd written about highlighting, obviously, health disparities between women and men, between people of color and white patients. And to be perfectly honest, in the field of healthcare, although there have been people who have been drawing attention to these disparities for quite some time, it feels as if only relatively recently it's become something that medicine and the healthcare field overall are talking about and talking about in a way of like, what can we do about it? So I guess that's my way of asking, was this a difficult decision for you to make? Because it seems as if some of the work that you've been doing for so long, you know, healthcare itself is at a turning point, and you could actually maybe accomplish a great deal in terms of closing those disparity gaps between women and men, people of color, et cetera.
No, it's a great question. And, you know, if you think about where we are today, those differences, the disparities are highlighted. And we've done a lot of work, not only on the discovery side, the science side, but how do we also change the policies so that science is actually done differently, is performed differently. But it really takes young people who are thinking differently to make that change a transformational change and to make that change one that is sustaining. And that in many ways is what excites me about Wellesley. As we think about educating our young women, allowing them and nurturing them to grow and to think critically, to think out of the box, to ask the questions that we haven't asked. That is exactly the kind of thinking we need to advance fields of science, medicine, and so many more in our country, in our world. And so in many ways, what I've worked on with my colleagues, who will absolutely continue the work and will continue to grow it, what we are now doing is ensuring that we are educating that next generation to, in fact, take it yet a step farther. And so in many ways, it's a natural continuation of the work I've really spent over my life.
I do want to get to your background a little bit more in a second, but it seems as if you're saying that there's also something unique that you yourself can bring to Wellesley, being, you know, being a physician, a scientist, to a historically liberal arts college.
I would hope so. And no, I do think that my background, once again, which is somewhat different, even in medicine, you know, I think bringing the field that we, with my colleagues, have nurtured, but also thinking about other fields, the field of public health. You know, health is influenced by the environment, and there are very significant sex differences. How do we begin to think about that lens and then bringing it to the policy side? There are opportunities to bring that framework to a liberal arts college in a way that allows young women to imagine opportunities for them that either exist today or even might not exist. The opportunities, the field that I'm in, didn't really exist in this way when I was in college. So for me, having a strong liberal arts education, really being encouraged to think differently, to think and to ask questions that, quite frankly, weren't being asked, really led to this work. So I think bringing my own experience, which is deeply rooted in the academy, gives me not only that lens, but I think it also gives me the lens of really appreciating the academic culture, the deep commitment by the faculty to the Wellesley mission and to academic excellence. I think it gives me a lens from several directions. And there's one other area that I think is worth talking about, which is that, you know, the health of our students across the country is an area that many colleges and universities are looking at. And my experience in women's health, looking at sex differences, I think will also help me bring that expertise to Wellesley. You know, we know that rates, for example, rates of depression and anxiety in high school students are at an all-time high. And we also know that there are significant sex differences in how those disorders are experienced. Women, young women, having higher rates of depression, higher rates of anxiety. These are our students. How do we ensure that we create the healthiest environment possible so that when our students leave us and enter an ever-increasingly complex world, they are not only educated in the most traditional sense, but they are also leaving with a healthy body and a healthy mind. And I think when you think about all three of those, that is what launches our next generation in the most powerful way.
So there are many reasons that I'm sure that Wellesley is celebrating luring you over here. On the flip side of that, I imagine Brigham and Women's Hospital is weeping at your departure, over your departure. But if we could, let's talk for a moment about your sort of personal path, if we could. Because I read that, so you grew up in Brooklyn.
I did. Before it was a cool place to live.
Yeah, before it was hip and impossible.
Right, in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and impossible
when
to
it was nearly bankrupt.
But I read that you didn't have there weren't a lot of doctors in your family, or you didn't have any mentors in the medical field as a young person.
No.
How did you know you wanted to be a doctor then?
It was interesting. So my mother was a school secretary, and she unfortunately passed away. I mean, it's one major regret of mine that she is not here to share this moment with me. I have a sister who's 3 years younger, and my father, who's 86, is still alive and will be here today. But I had, you know, although they were not college graduates, a very strong family, and my mother was incredibly committed to our education, to our independence, to our developing strong minds. And I didn't have any doctors in the family, but, you know, I unfortunately had one of my beloved grandmother, my mother's mother, suffered from depression, very serious depression over her life. And I saw that journey and saw what she faced. And I think just like many young people, when you see the adversity, you want to think about how might I be a part of the solution. And so I think very early on, that was part of what motivated me to want to be a physician.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit more about life growing up in Brooklyn?
So I grew up in a neighborhood. Back then it was called Flatbush. Now it's called Prospect Lefferts Gardens. It's the non-fancy side of Prospect Park, and went to public school. Went to public elementary, junior high school, and high school. You know, my mother was extremely influential and important in finding the best schools that she could for us in the area. You know, I really wanted to go to a fine liberal arts college. And I was 15 when I started looking at colleges. I was 16 when I left, so I was very young. And I ended up coming here to Harvard Radcliffe.
Wow. I only say wow because 16.
Yeah, I was 16.
Oh, and then Harvard Medical School.
Yes.
And then you did your residency here.
At Brigham and Women's, got a master's in public health as well during my medical school years. Took off some time, did that. And then trained in
cardiology,
internal medicine, and then cardiology, medical cardiology.
Okay.
And practiced in transplant. But my earliest work as an investigator, as a clinical investigator, was really understanding the sex and race differences in how patients experience symptoms of a heart attack and what the medical system does or doesn't do in response to those symptoms. So how do we better understand differences in presentation of illness between women and men and minority women? And then how do we think about the healthcare system's response, which then led to work on how do we change that system? And that's really the earliest roots of my work in women's health, which then at the Connor Center really is across all disciplines.
Your trajectory, regardless of your race or gender, has been phenomenal. You're an incredibly accomplished person. But as an African-American woman, I'm wondering, you know, were there challenges that you faced as you rose through the ranks in medicine?
There, you know, when you are in the minority, there always are. And I think that the sometimes the lack of seeing people like you in leadership, that's a gap. And there aren't many. And so for me, I think I've always been very cognizant of that, have looked for mentors, and I say mentors or people to bring into the fold for my own life. And it's usually not one, but many who serve different roles. But internalizing that and then understanding what it takes to lead either a division or the center that I lead, and internalizing those experiences and making sure that we really rethink how we lead. What is inclusive leadership? How do we ensure voices are heard? How do we ensure we pattern and model the behavior and allow people into our lives to understand what is possible for them? I think that's been a theme of my own leadership, you know, at Brigham and Women's, and I would hope, and at Harvard Medical School, and I would hope that is a theme of my leadership. And I think what I would bring to Wellesley, as we think about how to make Wellesley, it's already committed to diversity, equity, inclusion, but as we think about even deepening those commitments, how do we bring my life lessons to my leadership here at Wellesley?
Wellesley President Dr. Paula Johnson speaking to us back in February. Today, Dr. Johnson was officially inaugurated as the first African-American president at Wellesley College. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Gary Gulman is a Peabody native and a very funny guy. You might have seen the comedian on Conan O'Brien's TBS show or on NBC's Last Comic Standing. Gulman's style is the comedic slow burn. Here's just a bit of a sketch he recently did on Conan about smartphones and how they've made everyone even more unreasonable.
If you use it on me, oh, God help you. How dare you? I am furious when I get a phone call. You text me first to see if I'm even taking phone calls today. And I'll text you back with a window. But we are relentless with how we want the phone to be better. Like, we want all our music on the phone. You want all your music on the phone. No, I'm sorry. I misspoke. We want all the music. Every song ever on our phone now. Okay, but like, what are you willing to pay for that? Pay for it? Nothing! Nothing! Nothing. My offer is this. Nothing.
Gary Gulman will be at the Wilbur Theater tomorrow night. He recently sat down with us to talk about his winding path into comedy.
I was raised by a single mother. I would entertain her at night over the dinner table and basically do routines that I had seen on the Dinah Shore show or on Merv Griffin or on Mike Douglas shows that were on in the afternoon and imitate the comedians that I had seen.
So was it those dinner table conversations that really made you fall in love with comedy, or did it come?
Well, I was in love with it just from watching it. My mom was pretty nice about letting me stay up to watch Johnny Carson when I was a kid, so I would see David Brenner and Robert Klein and Gary Shandling. I fell in love with it. I found it so magic how they were able to tell these stories or tell these jokes that I could really relate to. Even when I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old, I really could laugh and enjoy them and then repeat the jokes and get laughs from adults. So,
you know, you were talking about how a lot of the comedians that you watched as a kid, their comedy came through the form of stories. And it seems like there's a lot of that in what you do now. And I want to just play a clip here because you tell this winding story with some laughs along the way, of course, but there's always a huge payoff at the end. And this clip is from your most recent special, which is on Netflix. The special is called It's About Time. And you're talking about the fact that you're in bed and you want to watch Shawshank Redemption. You say that you told your older brother about buying the movie on iTunes and,
yes,
and then that was a mistake. And here's what you say.
Yeah, what are you doing, yeah? What are you doing, kid? Come on, pal, buddy, chief, boss, dude, bro, guy. What are you doing buying a movie you already own for $15? Like, what, it's $15. Who cares about $15? Nah, it adds up, kid. It adds up, guy. $15 here, $15 there, it adds up, guy. Not my philosophy. It adds up. Please. Let me tell you something, and pay attention, because this is true. It only adds up if you add it up.
So, Gary, I'm curious, is that what your brother really said?
No. I have a theory that Christians have an angel and a devil on their shoulder, and Jews have other Jews on their shoulder, that my entire family is on my shoulder at all times. So my brother, who's on my shoulder at all times, questioning my moves and my decisions and my purchases, was there. But my actual brother, he didn't actually say that. It was just it was a conversation I had with my brother on my shoulder, if you will, and that was the result.
Where do you get most of your inspiration from?
I would say I get a lot of it just from everyday events that happen to me, stories that run-ins I have with life and the things that irritate me. I wouldn't call myself overly irritable, but I know that if there's some irritation, there's probably a joke there and there's something that other people can relate to, because I think it was Emerson who said that the personal is universal. So I really believe in that I can talk about things that happen to me and the people can relate to them readily.
You know, I'm thinking about, I just rewatched this routine that you did where you had this hilarious joke which had me in stitches about role playing with your girlfriend to spice up
your
intimate life, and you're a college, a Jewish college professor in a college that didn't hire Jews,
and they didn't hire Jews,
and she wanted extra credit. I mean, that one.
Well, she wasn't pulling her weight in class, it turns out she just wanted sex, but I wanted her to be a better student.
And not waste her parents' money.
Right, exactly.
She said, oh, yeah? You going to give me some extra credit? I would love some extra credit. I said, I'll give you more extra credit than you can handle. And she said, I believe I can take every inch of your extra credit. And I said, that's not how we measure extra credit. I don't know what they did at UMass, but here.
This little clip from you on Conan O'Brien. That little shot at UMass there.
Yeah, my brothers went to UMass, and I always deride UMass because I went to Boston College. So there's a rivalry there.
You didn't go straight into comedy. You went into accounting?
Yes, yes. I worked for what is now PricewaterhouseCoopers. Is that what?
Yeah, I think they're just PwC now.
They're PwC now. Yeah, I was an accountant for 2 years, and I was incompetent and very distracted because I was doing stand-up comedy at night at open mics and amateur shows wherever I could get on stage.
Well, so was Boston or Greater Boston a good place for, you know, building that comedy career?
It was great. There were a lot of opportunities to get on stage, and the audiences were very generous and a good test of material. And the other comedians were so good. There was a lot of inspiration and a lot of people to motivate you to get better. So I think it was the ideal place to start doing comedy.
But so let me play a different clip entirely. This is from your 2012 special, In This Economy. And you talk about billionaires, particularly Bill Gates, who at the time in 2012 was worth $59 billion. It's now more than $90 billion, by the way.
I know.
So and part of your routine involved you saying that the best part of being Bill Gates is that he could talk down to Donald Trump.
Sees him at a party, goes up to him. Hey, what's up, Trump? Just looks at him with that disdain that nobody else really can. What's up, Trump? You sicken me. You're so tacky. You're so gauche. I made $59 billion. And I call my business Microsoft. I don't call it Gatesware. You egomaniac. You put your name on everything. Trump on everything. It's not underwear. You're not going off to summer camp. Stop it.
Given the fact that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for president in 2016, how does that joke sound to your ears right now?
It sounds very, very odd because I didn't realize he was actually going to be this much trouble. I mean, I don't remember the timing of the special, but it had to have been after the birther movement, because I think the birther movement was during Obama's first term. So yeah, I think that's what got under my skin about Donald Trump, and I quote unquote let him have it with that. But he bounced back after that. I'm surprised he was able to handle such a shellacking by me.
What's something you think most people would be surprised to know about you?
That I suffer from a pretty severe depression. I was diagnosed at 19, but I think for a lot of my life I experienced these kind of dark moods that were really really problematic and continue to be. But it's something that I've addressed with therapy and medicine, and hopefully I'll put it behind me for good.
Problematic how?
There are some days that it's just very difficult for me to get out of bed and function, and I'm so critical of myself that it's very difficult for me to write new jokes. I'll just be so critical of them, or even critical of the things that I already have, that it's just the self-criticism can be overwhelming and paralyzing.
Well, Gary, if you don't mind me asking, it seems to me that for someone suffering from such deep depression, getting up on stage is like the last thing that that they might want to do, right?
Yeah, there are some nights where it is the last thing I want to do, and I have a 100 different pep talks that I give myself, and I must say that I 100% of the time feel better after I've done the shows. But then there's a lot of times a reset in the morning, and it's very difficult to internalize and hold on to the feelings that I had the night before from the shows. So it's a paradox, I know.
It is a paradox. I mean, I'm only saying this because I feel like, I mean, everyone sort of who experiences depression, it manifests in different ways, but like there's this urge, I'm just speaking from personal experience, to hide, right, and to withdraw. But yeah, you're doing the exact opposite. You're making yourself like vulnerable in the most public way.
Yeah. I have plenty of time during the day to isolate and hide and stay away from interaction with people. But And some nights it's just like, listen, you're going to get into a lot of trouble if you don't show up to the show. So you have to do this, and it doesn't have to be perfect. Just go up there and say your first lines, and I bet you'll be able to get through it. And so far, so good.
I have to say, I'm really moved. I'm really touched by the fact that there's a lot of effort that you have to put in to do what you do every day.
Yeah.
What do you love most about doing this?
When I can get a new joke to work, when a new joke that I thought of recently gets people to laugh, that's like a high that I can't compare. It really makes me feel like I'm still creative, like I'm still viable, like I'm still relevant and smart, and it just it makes me feel really good about myself and the direction my career is going. I get an excitement that's unmatched really in my life.
Well, Gary Goldman will be performing at the Wilbur on Saturday, October 1st. His latest special is called It's About Time. You can see it on Netflix, but better yet, go see him at the Wilbur on Saturday. Gary, thank you so much. It was really great to talk with you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. You're wonderful.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In August 2014, American hostage Theo Padnos was released by al-Qaeda in Syria, almost 2 years after he'd first been captured on the Turkey-Syria border.
And they tied my legs up, and they said, we're from the al-Qaeda organization, the name al-Qaeda, and you're our prisoner now. Then they all started laughing. You know, they thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I'm thinking, I committed suicide, but I'm still alive.
Well, that clip is from a new documentary called Theo Who Lived. In it, Padnos returns to the region to tell the story of his captivity, how he survived physical and mental torture, and the consequences of 3 failed escape attempts. Theo Who Lived is screening at the Brattle Theater tonight as part of the Globe Docs Film Festival. But Theo Padnos joins us now in the Radio Boston studio. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming in. I got a lot of questions for you.
Please, go ahead. Ask away.
I guess the first one that I kept coming back to while watching the documentary was, for someone who had experienced all that you had in those 22 months in captivity, it would be totally understandable to say to any filmmaker or any journalist, I don't ever want to go back there. I don't want to have to necessarily go back to the region or even mentally go back to the memories. And yet you did, in a very brave and honest way in this film. Why did you want to do that?
I'm interested in what's happening on the ground in Syria. You know, we didn't actually go back into the country. But why did I want to revisit these memories? I mean, I'm interested in making art out of the trauma of that war, I suppose, or my own experience within that war. I'm interested in bringing sense to the chaos on the ground, and I think I have an unusual perspective because I have lived with the rebels, I think, for longer than any other living journalist, except John Cantley, who's still in captivity, by the way. We should all continue to think about him. As far as we know, he's still alive. He's a British journalist who's been held for almost 4 years by now, even longer. But anyway, I'm the only person who's survived and is out now. And, you know, these guys from the al-Qaeda organization, they always used to say to me, nobody knows us like you know us. So, and they wanted me to, you know, come out and tell the truth about them. And, of course, it's a complicated truth in that there are many, many characters involved. Not everybody has the same motives. Not everybody speaks the same language. Not everybody has the same religious point of view, although the goal of the organization is to make everybody the same, as in any army.
Well, Theo Padnos, let me just jump in here for a second, because when you say that the al-Qaeda members who, let's be honest, had captured you and held you hostage and tortured you, I mean, you talk about the brutal physical torture that you underwent in detail in this documentary, that these men told you that nobody understands them and they wanted you to tell the world who they are. I mean, the world sees them as as terrorists.
Right. Yes, of course. I mean, it was maybe 2 years into this, or almost 2 years, at which point they and you know, we had developed a relationship that, you know, I think there was some mutual respect. I respected certain things about them. I think they're brutal. I forgave them for what they did to me, but I will not forgive them for what they're doing to their country and to their fellow citizens, to the women and to the kids. I mean, I couldn't tell them this at the time, but I know what they are doing to their fellow citizens, and I won't forgive them for that. Like, I survived. I'm fine. I can run around, play soccer, play tennis, ride my bike. I'm fine, but there are so many that are not, and it's, you know, and I know what they want to do to their neighbors. So I can't forgive them for any of this, and I won't. But anyway, I mean, my goal as a journalist is to understand and to, you know, better understand the psychology that brings them to the point of causing such chaos and damage in the world.
Yeah, so tell me more about the things that you experienced in those 22 months in Syria as a hostage that brought you closer to what you think is your new understanding. I mean, I just wonder, because so much of the documentary traces the physical torture that you went through.
Really?
That's what it seemed like to me. I mean, there's a long section in which you talk about the beatings that you took and the fact that you spent 200 days in essentially a small box.
Right. I mean, it was longer than that, to be honest. Okay, I mean, they were mean to me, certainly. I don't only draw that meanness out of my experience. Like, there were other times when they were nice to me. I mean, of course, when you write or make a movie about a particular experience, you're going to focus on certain aspects, but another person would focus on other aspects, and perhaps at a different time in your life, you would look back on that experience, and other memories would seem more important, more consequential, more, you know, more important to tell the world about. At the moment, you know, listen, this documentary does talk a little bit, or perhaps even a lot, about the physical suffering that they inflict on their prisoners. I mean, but I'm really, to be honest, I mean, at the moment, I'm interested in what they are trying to accomplish psychologically with the people of Syrian Muslims everywhere. I mean, they really have a program for the psychological alteration of, like, of the way people think. They want to change your mind. And,
was your and mind changed in any way?
It was. It certainly
How?
Was. I was, I mean, I think they wanted me to submit to their authority, which I did as deeply as I possibly could. I was so terrified of them. I was so needy and just helpless before them that, you know, a look or a gesture or when I smelled them. When I heard their voices from far away, I was terrified, and I was having the kinds of reactions that they would like you to have, and not just terror, but also, you know, some of these people have a kind of deep Islamic learning, so and I'm also interested in that, and you know, one way they want you to respect their learning. And I learned to do that, I think. I mean, I learned to do their connection with the Quran, for instance, their connection with the Hadith, their connection with the religion. I have no patience for people who say that these people are not Muslims. Neither do they, by the way. I mean, they have a deep and powerful and abiding connection with the religion of Islam. So, I mean, take this for what you make of this what you will. It's to
well,
me,
I
it's
want
very
you to help me. I'd like actually, I'd appreciate you to help me make of it what you're trying to say, because I'm struggling here a little bit. I mean, is it that I don't want to oversimplify, but help me understand. Mm-hmm. Do you see Al-Qaeda in Syria as a force with motives that you can understand, or do you approve of their motives?
Very much against killing women on the street for no reason. Beating journalists, beheading people for no reason. I'm very much against this. Yeah. I mean, these are people are they commit unspeakable crimes against their fellow citizens and against us, and they would do it more if they could. They're not nice people. And by the way, when we talk about al-Qaeda in Syria, I mean, this is a major misconception, but it is certainly true that when you, for instance, if you were to go to the town of Binish today, where I was kidnapped, where James Foley was kidnapped, currently controlled by a group called Jabhat Fateh Sham, this is the new incarnation of Jabhat al-Nusra, you know, I strongly suspect that if you went to any citizen in this town as a journalist, particularly from America, but probably from anywhere, they would turn you over to the ruling authorities. I think there's a 99% likelihood of that. I think the ruling authorities would then begin the torture almost right away. Mm-hmm. That's what happened to me. It's not, it's a mistake to think of the dangers for us as I thought of it in the very beginning, just an isolated group of like religious fanatics. They're probably off in the woods somewhere. You're never going to run into them. No, it's there is a religious enthusiasm that has consumed large portions of the country. In certain parts of the country, it's called Daesh or ISIS. In other parts, it's called Jabhat Fateh Sham. Other parts, it was called, like in the suburbs of Damascus, Jaish al-Islam.
Yeah.
So, but it's the same phenomenon under different names in many different places, and it makes it so, it's incredibly dangerous, unpredictable. We don't understand these forces that are at work. What are the forces? It's certainly, there are Islamic forces in there. There are tribal forces. There are, personal vendettas that are occurring. The lust for money.
Theo, forgive me for jumping in, but I keep reminding myself that you have, I have to say, a tragically unique view, right, of what's going on in the catastrophe, the human catastrophe that is Syria right now. And one of the things is that the reason why you have that view beyond the truth of your captivity was that you were actually able to speak, right, with your captors. Was there anything that they told you during that time or things that helped you further understand? Understand, like, tell me what some of the things
Quran.
They told you.
I was
you.
In the prison with the ISIS guys a lot, and they were very dutiful. Like, they were probably about to be killed, and I think they knew this because Jabhat al-Nusra, my group, was battling ISIS at the time. ISIS had been killing a lot of the Jabhat guys. When the Jabhat al-Nusra formations captured the ISIS people, they killed them. And I think that the captors knew that the guys, my prison neighbors, my cellmates, had recently killed their own brothers, you know? Mm-hmm. So they put him in jail and they go, okay, we're going to come for you. Like they were saying to each other, we're going to go get that guy, Abu Hamza, and kill him tonight. Mm-hmm. And I think Abu Hamza knew that. So what was your question? Oh, what did they tell me? Like, what did I learn from these guys? Well, we would spend a lot of time reading the Quran. I had a beautiful experience, maybe not beautiful. Let's say I had an experience with the Quran. It was frightening, to be honest. You know, it's a terrifying atmosphere. We're being bombed from the air. ISIS guys in the cells next to me. Now there, everybody's saying, these guys might kill you.
Right.
Fortunately, they couldn't get out of their cell and come get me. Jabhat al-Nusra guys could have come killed me at any time. There's Free Syrian Army factions that maybe are angry. There was the regime army. I don't know, U.S. bombs. The U.S. I didn't want them to try to rescue me. Because I knew I would be killed right away, as Luke Summers was killed in Yemen.
During the attempted rescue.
In an attempted rescue. So, we were terrified pretty much all the time.
Well, I wish we had more time. Maybe sometime you can come back and talk with us, because you see that clock there. We're just down to a minute. I feel kind of ironic in saying I wish we had more time, because when you were in captivity, time was all you had.
I had tons of time. I'll come back anytime for you. No problem.
Do you mind if I just ask one last quick question? Sure. We just have a couple seconds. How are you doing today? Because a person comes out of something like that.
I feel very good. Very invigorated. I think I was like a little bit depressed, you know, before I went in, and now I'm very happy. So therapeutically, it was very helpful for me. I mean, I don't recommend this for like other people, but for me, it was a positive overall thing for me. Like I went in not too happy and I came out delighted with everything. So that's my state of mind now.
Well, Theo Padnos was held captive by the al-Nusra Front in Syria from 2012 to 2014. There's a new documentary about his experience. It's playing tonight at the Brattle Theater as part of the Globe Docs Film Festival. thank you.
Thank you.
So much for coming in. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.